This is NBC Nightly News, Tuesday, November 6th. Reported by John Chancellor with David Brinkley's Journal.
Good evening. It appears tonight as though more maneuvering is going on involving President Nixon's secret tapes. Federal Judge John Sirica was closeted with two of the president's lawyers this afternoon, but no one at that meeting is saying what went on. There has been a report that the president may ask Judge Sirica to listen to the tapes and make summaries of them public. Earlier in the day, in Judge Sirica's courtroom, it was learned that Rosemary Woods, the president's personal secretary, has 14 of the secret tapes in her possession, including six that were given to her on Monday of this week. And as Carl Stern reports, the secret tapes have had wide distribution.
Despite assurances that the presidential tape recordings remain snugly locked up in the White House, it turned out in court today that the tapes have been shuttled back and forth repeatedly between the White House, Maryland, and Florida, that eight of the most important tapes delivered to the president's secretary in September have never been returned, and that she got six more of them from the White House vaults yesterday.
White House aide Stephen Bull testified that the president had been hard at work for more than a month now going over the tapes and having them reduced to writing. When the president went to Key Biscayne, the tapes went with him, placed under armed guard round the clock. Prosecutor Richard Benveniste plugged away at the secrecy of the operation. At Camp David, for example, where the tapes were removed from view when a delivery man came in. Benveniste asked, "Were you hiding them?" Bull's reply, "I thought it in the best interest of all that we not advertise what we were doing. But there was no chicanery, there are no missing tapes, the explanations are logical." He was followed to the stand by the White House custodian of the tapes, General John Bennett. He disclosed that only yesterday the president asked to hear a new batch of tapes of his April 16th conversations with John Dean. Chief Judge John Sirica hinted that maybe the best witness of all would be the president's secretary, Rosemary Woods, who is transcribing the tapes. He ordered her called. No one closer to the president has ever testified. So, after today's testimony, there was still no evidence from Bull or anyone else that the president destroyed any tapes. But it was clear that the president has spent an enormous amount of time concerning himself about the tapes and perhaps reviewing whether public disclosure of some or all might not be useful now. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
Elliot Richardson, the former attorney general who resigned because the president was firing Archibald Cox, was talking about Cox's work before the Senate Judiciary Committee today. Richardson said that if Cox's investigations had led to indictments, there would have been nothing which would have inflicted additional damage on the White House or on the president. Here's more on Richardson from Paul Duke.
As a troubleshooting cabinet officer, Richardson appeared before congressional committees dozens of times. Today, he came as a private citizen. And in that role, he urged Congress to compel the president to give a personal pledge guaranteeing the independence of the new prosecutor. Under questioning by senators, he said Mr. Nixon should make a statement promising to release all relevant White House material, including any papers and tapes affecting the Vesco, Milk Fund, and ITT cases, as well as Watergate. If any dispute arose, Richardson said the prosecutor should have the automatic right to go to court to seek what he wants. Senator Kennedy wanted to know, how do you get the president to sign on the dotted line, giving his word? Well, said Richardson, have him sign on the line or his new attorney general, William Saxby, might not be confirmed. Richardson said he did not believe the president was trying to cover up in denying information to ousted prosecutor Archibald Cox, but said there is now a need for full disclosure of everything.
The situation confronting the nation today is certainly one of deeply eroded confidence in the integrity of government generally and of the office of the presidency itself. The point is that we are in a situation where public confidence has to be restored. And the question then is, what can the president do to restore it? And what I've been saying in effect is that I think he can only do this by making as clear as possible his commitment to the independence of the special prosecutor, and by making clear in advance that whatever information the special prosecutor needs will be made available to him.
Richardson's testimony adds to the growing clamor from prominent Republicans for unqualified White House cooperation in getting to the bottom of the scandals. It means more pressure on the president to turn over all tapes and documents sought by federal investigators. Paul Duke, NBC News, at the Capitol.
There was some reaction today to the editorials over the weekend calling for the president's resignation. Mrs. Claire Booth Luce, widow of the man who helped found Time magazine, disagreed with the magazine's editorial asking that Mr. Nixon resign. Mrs. Luce said, "That is a job for the people." And the Washington Post, which has been highly critical of the president, said Mr. Nixon's resignation now would be wrong, that it might lead to a backlash if the question of his guilt or innocence is not properly determined. The Senate Watergate Committee met today and voted to seek a face-to-face meeting with the president on Watergate. The White House had no specific comment. Later on the program, we'll have a report on what the president plans to do about the energy crisis. We'll have the latest on the situation in the Middle East, and we'll have a final report on Malcolm Forbes, the mad rich balloonist.
Good news from Oster!
This is the Osterizer, the original all-family blender. What's in it for you? Well, there's Nick's drinks, chocolate shakes, ham and macaroni bakes, cheese dips, Swiss fondue, sauce for Western barbecue, hot and spicy apple bread, peanut butter sandwich spread, sauce with wine, sauce with mustard, and lots more. The secret of these happy blends? Controlled cycle blending. That's Osterizer Spin Cookery. There's an Osterizer model for everyone.
My stomach feel lousy.
Maybe you're coming down with something.
Yeah, with your sister's cooking.
Well, maybe you're just upset.
My stomach's upset from your sister's cooking.
Well, she does need help.
She needs help. I need help.
Here.
Upset stomach? Pepto-Bismol. Pepto-Bismol coats and soothes. Comes between the upset and the stomach.
And that'll settle that.
The White House announced today that President Nixon will address the country on radio and television this week on the energy crisis. The address could be broadcast as early as tomorrow night. At the White House, Tom Brokaw has learned of some of the ideas and proposals which may be in the president's speech.
President Nixon and his advisors have settled on several proposals for dealing with the fuel shortage that is expected soon. These are not final solutions, they're emergency measures designed to make the best of a bad situation. Here are some that are getting most of the attention. A fuel allotment program that would mean schools and businesses would have a choice between turning down the temperatures in their heating system or changing their schedules so they're not operating during the colder parts of the day. A suspension or reduction in clean air standards so more coal could be used. Anyone using more than the allotted amount of fuel would have to pay an additional fee. The president is also said to be considering the creation of a national committee to police all of these programs, and he may open the possibility for the rationing of gasoline on cars. It now appears likely that Mr. Nixon will talk about all of these recommendations in a national television speech. According to one source within the White House, that decision came only after a lengthy debate within Mr. Nixon's inner circle as to whether such a speech would bring out more accusations that the president was trying to divert attention from Watergate. Tom Brokaw, NBC News, at the White House.
On that matter, incidentally, a White House spokesman said today that the president does plan to speak out further on the Watergate issue at a time and in a forum to be decided later. Stuart Udall, the former Secretary of the Interior, said last night that Americans are energy pigs, that the fuel crisis is a long-term problem, and that we can expect, he said, our first cold shower in about 60 days. And the common market countries, worried about having their fuel cut off by the Arabs, met in Brussels today and decided to support the Egyptian position in negotiating a new truce line in the Middle East. The nine market countries acted in a special and independent way, which was a severe blow to European unity as envisioned under the common market. Bernard Kaplan has more on this from Brussels.
As though to symbolize how much the oil issue has divided the European community, the nine foreign ministers did not meet at the European community headquarters.
Instead, they chose a little Belgian chateau where they could sit down as strictly national foreign ministers representing strictly national interests. And in what was supposed to be a key test for European unity, it was strictly national interests that won the day. The countries hoping to escape the full brunt of Arab oil cuts turned a deaf ear toward those already faced by it. Instead of an agreement on sharing their oil, all the nine could come up with was yet another declaration on a Middle East settlement. The declaration supported most Arab demands. Officials here denied that it was drawn up with an eye to protecting European oil supplies from further cuts. With oil shortages mounting in several common market countries, the British and French refused to consider pooling the common market's oil resources. The Dutch pressed hardest for this. Accused by the Arabs of being pro-Israeli, the Dutch are under a Middle East oil boycott. But at today's meeting, Britain and France said if the other common market countries pitched in to help the Dutch, it would only result in Arab reprisals against all of them. And that appeared too much to pay for European unity. Bernard Kaplan, NBC News, Brussels.
And the Japanese, faced with grave problems because of Arab cutbacks in oil, experts also urged today that the Israelis withdraw to territories held before the 1967 Middle East War.
Have you noticed how many foreign-made products are being imported these days? Manufacturers overseas are churning out high-quality products at attractive prices. They're providing stiff competition to one American industry after another. At United States Steel, we know one way to meet this challenge is to improve productivity. Here in Utah, at our Geneva Works, both labor and management are seeking ways to be more efficient, to produce more steel at the lowest possible cost. Regular meetings like this are helping us find new methods and develop better attitudes toward our work. U.S. Steel is determined to do the best job possible so we can compete. That spirit helped make this country the most productive in the world. We're trying to keep it that way. At United States Steel, we're involved.
The Israeli government said today that 1,854 Israeli soldiers were killed in the new Middle East war. 1,800 were wounded. The death toll is the highest in any of the four Arab-Israeli wars, with the exception of the 1948 conflict. That lasted longer, and that took the lives of 5,000 Israeli troops. For the last week, there have been pessimistic intelligence reports out of the Middle East regarding a possible resumption of the war. At the heart of these reports is the belief that Egypt may do almost anything to rescue its Third Army. That army is surrounded by Israeli troops on the west bank of the Suez Canal and by another sizable Israeli force across the canal. Today, American intelligence sources tended to confirm that fighting may break out again. John Cochran has the story.
U.S. intelligence reports indicate the Egyptians are moving into position to try to break out the trapped remnants of the Third Army. The reports indicate Egypt has sent 15 to 20,000 troops around the Israeli flank in the north and an armored force of more than 150 tanks around the Israelis in the south near Suez City. If heavy fighting does resume in the Sinai, it's believed Syria will help the Egyptians by launching a ground attack in the north. But the weather in Syria is getting worse, and U.S. officials believe that if Syria is going to help the Egyptians, it must do it right away. That and the movement of Egyptian troops has worried U.S. officials to the point that they believe the ceasefire may break down within a week. But U.S. officials believe the Egyptians will hold off any attack until after Henry Kissinger completes his talks in Cairo. John Cochran, NBC News, Washington.
And against this ominous background, Secretary Kissinger carried out his Middle East peace mission today in three Arab countries. In Rabat, Morocco, Kissinger spent 7 hours with King Hassan. In Tunis, he was closeted with President Habib Bourguiba of Tunisia for 4 hours. And tonight, he flew into Cairo for the most crucial talks of all, those he will hold with President Anwar Sadat of Egypt. Richard Valeriani is traveling with the Kissinger party, and we have a satellite report from Morocco.
For Kissinger, who's Jewish, this was his first visit ever to an Arab country. It was also the first time, his aide said, that despite all his traveling, a formal welcoming ceremony had been arranged for him at the airport. The extra security made it somewhat hectic. One newspaper here hailed Kissinger on his arrival as a pilgrim for peace, but American officials said they do not expect spectacular or dramatic results from his trip. They described his mission as the start of a process toward peace negotiations in the Middle East. Kissinger wasted no time in seeing King Hassan. He went to the king's country villa for a meeting that lasted past midnight. Today, they conferred again at the royal palace. Hassan is not a central figure in the Arab-Israeli dispute, but he did send token forces to both Egypt and Syria, and he is well connected with the Palestinian guerrillas. Kissinger is not only explaining his peacemaking role to Arab leaders on this trip, he's also soliciting their views. And he's trying to emphasize Washington's desire for maintaining good relations with the Arab world as well. Richard Valeriani, NBC News in Rabat, Morocco.
It was disclosed today that Kissinger will be too busy to be in Oslo, Norway, on December 10th to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. At the moment, Kissinger has his hands full with the Middle East. David Brinkley thinks that if he can bring off peace there, then the Secretary of State might be in line for another prize. David?
Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize for his negotiating in Vietnam. If he can now do the same in the Middle East, the American people might award him the Exalted Order of the Warm Socks. And he will have earned it. The U.S. was running short of oil even before the Middle Eastern War. With the war and the American support of Israel, it is worse. So, Washington is planning for rationing if necessary, earlier closing hours, burning more coal even though it pollutes, some limits on driving cars. While the Arab states have embargoed all shipments to the U.S., they've also cut back their production, and so European countries that carefully did not support Israel are hit too, because they are more dependent on Arab oil than Americans are. It might occur to the Arab leaders that nobody knows how long the Western industrial countries will remain peaceful and passive if their houses are cold, automobiles parked, schools closed, industries and jobs shut down. And Israel will be under heavy pressure, in fact already is. The 9 European common market countries now demand Israel give up all the occupied Arab lands. Well, that kind of pressure is, of course, what the Arab states had in mind. And for them, their plan is working like a charm. So it is essential that Kissinger or somebody help find a settlement in the Middle East, because the alternative is severe discord, social, political, economic, and possibly even military. John?
In South Vietnam, a barrage of rockets struck the big air base at Bien Hoa, north of Saigon today. The Saigon government saw the rocket attack as the beginning of a new enemy offensive.
There's not much difference in pain relievers that you can see, but in your bloodstream, the differences are very real. While all three leading pain relievers reach an effective level in minutes, in the final analysis, only one of them hits and holds the highest level, Anacin. This difference is the extra pain reliever Anacin provides when you have a headache. Remember, the difference in Anacin is the higher level of pain reliever. Anacin relieves pain fast.
Presenting the Sunbeam Hotshot Beverage Maker. Because everybody wants their instant drinks in an instant.
Cup of coffee fast, dear. Gotta catch the early train.
Mm-hmm. Mommy, could I have my chocolate now, please?
Yes, dear.
The Sunbeam Hotshot heats two cups of water steaming hot in about 90 seconds.
Tea, please. I have to catch a bus.
Sure, Mom. Think I'll have a cup of chicken soup.
Or instant drinks, get the Sunbeam Hotshot Beverage Maker.
Robert Vesco, the fugitive financier, has been arrested in the Bahamas and is out on bail pending extradition to New York City in a fraud case. Vesco, who gave $250,000 to the committee to re-elect the president in 1972, is a co-defendant in another criminal case with former Nixon cabinet members John Mitchell and Maurice Stans. Vesco has been sought in that matter since last May. Voters in Virginia and New Jersey are selecting new governors today. The outgoing governors are Republicans, and the results may be significant, since these are the first statewide elections since the Watergate scandal and since the resignation of Vice President Agnew. In California, voters will decide whether to approve Governor Reagan's proposal to limit the state's ability to tax. The result there could have a bearing on Reagan's political future. In New York City, voters will choose a successor to Mayor John Lindsay among four candidates. Voters in Detroit also will select a new mayor. The population there is almost evenly divided between blacks and whites, and race is an issue. Jack Paxton reports.
The Detroit mayoral race pits a black against a white. As the polls opened this morning, the contest was expected to be a close one. Last-minute opinion polls showed a large group of voters still undecided. John Nichols, a 54-year-old former police commissioner who was known as a tough cop and who stresses crime control, is running against Coleman Young, a 55-year-old state senator who has a reputation as a militant fighter for the black cause. Both men have exhibited a newfound moderation. They've stuck to the issues and avoided racial name-calling. But each is still a symbol of something that one half the city doesn't trust. And there's a feeling that race is the unspoken but real issue of this campaign. It's in the neighborhoods, black and white, where the racist campaign has been waged. People on both sides are reluctant to talk about it, but few deny it exists. Mel Ravitz, Detroit City Council president.
Whichever one of them does win, that candidate's going to have to bring back into the fold as much as possible those of the alienated other half in order to have a viable administration. If that doesn't take place, then there's going to be a continuing tension in this town that's going to make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to deal with the city's real problems.
No one is predicting disaster or even radical change because of this election. Whoever wins will have a hard time getting help from about half the population, but each candidate seems determined to bring the city together. Jack Paxton, NBC News, Detroit.
There was no progress today toward settlement of a strike against Transworld Airlines by stewardesses and stewards, nor was there any move to settle a dispute involving firemen in Milwaukee, who persisted in a sick call strike today despite a court order to return to normal operations. And firemen in New York City were on strike today, but only for a brief period. Richard Hunt reports.
For the first time in the 108-year history of the New York Fire Department, the firemen went on strike this morning, demanding a pay raise of $2,000 a year. Their base pay is now $14,300. At fire department headquarters, an emergency staff called each firehouse to find out which ones were even partly manned. In Manhattan, only four companies out of 83 were ready to answer an alarm. A skeleton crew of fire department officers fought this three-alarm fire in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn. The flames were whipped by high winds on the coldest day yet this fall. The cold made the risk of fires high throughout the city, because in cold weather, many poor New Yorkers use portable heaters, which cause many fires. No one was injured in this fire because the two buildings were vacant. But the buildings were destroyed, and a deputy chief was asked whether they could have been saved.
One probably not. The second one, definitely. The second building definitely would have been saved, yes. The big problem was worrying about the building with the people in them. That's what we were worried about. And we covered that with a line. We put out the fire on the roof of the building with the people in them. So that we took care of that.
After 5 hours on strike, the firemen went back to work. Their union and the city agreed to submit the dispute to an arbitration panel. Richard Hunt, NBC News, New York.
Stock prices fell again today in moderate trading. The Dow Jones Industrials were off another 6 points, down about 76 points in the last seven trading sessions. On the New York Exchange, the average price of a share decreased 24 cents. On the American Exchange, the average price of a share dropped 12 cents.
Old Man Winter isn't the only enemy of your car's cooling system. Corrosion is waiting to pounce on it, too. Fight back with Prestone 2 Winter Summer Protection. Only Prestone 2 has a patented silicone silicate formula. The Prestone Inhibitor System shields and preserves metal against rust and corrosion. Protect against freeze-up, boil-off, and corrosion with Prestone 2. If you can't trust Prestone, who can you trust?
How come she's not getting Alpa?
Apples for special, it costs more.
Sure, but for a few pennies more, you get a lot more beef.
Charlie, this has beef.
Baby, most dog foods don't have half the beef Alpa Beef Chunks Dinner has. Look, your brand or Alpa? Alpa's got lots of nourishing meat byproducts, real beef, plus soy vitamins and minerals.
She picked Alpa.
Sure. Alpo's got the meat she loves.
You're so smart.
Alpa, a few cents more, a lot more beef.
Malcolm Forbes, the mad rich balloonist, today completed his long leisurely trip across the United States. He started out more than a month ago at Coos Bay, Oregon, and he wound up today on the East Coast, or at least near enough to claim he did. Jack Perkins has the story.
For 5 weeks, while the rest of this country has been trying to get a new vice president, losing an attorney general and a special prosecutor, hassling about tape recordings, watching gasoline prices go up and the stock market go down, seeing the Middle East get into a war and then into a ceasefire, all this time, each day, Malcolm Forbes has been above it all, hanging in a wicker basket from a hot air balloon. His goal was to become the first person to cross this country coast to coast by balloon. He didn't do it because it was important. He did it because it was not important. He said, as the trip began, this trip is of no consequence, and that's the appeal of it. Well, today Malcolm Forbes came to the end of his remarkable journey. There was one slight problem. He didn't quite make it to the East Coast, if one must be technical. And there was another. He did not land on land. He landed in Chesapeake Bay. In the Chesapeake Bay. Forbes and his son jumped out of the gondola when it hit the water, and the balloon without them then went sailing off again on its own for a couple of miles, leaving them in water that was very cold, but their luck, it was also shallow, so they could stand until a fishing boat could come and rescue them.
I told you, from sea to shining sea. And I didn't mean it so literally. This is the end. We've, as far as I'm concerned, we've reached the East Coast.
You declare this the East Coast.
I declare this the East Coast. Chesapeake Bay in the mouth of the Potomac is the East Coast.
Well, in that case, congratulations.
Thank you. In that case, he says, like he doesn't believe it.
So for the past 5 weeks, while this country has been buffeted by so much history happening, Malcolm Forbes has been up there being blown about by the winds, wherever they wanted to take him. He figures he got the best end of the deal. Jack Perkins, NBC News, Gwynn's Island, Virginia.
And good night for NBC News.